Hello, doers, creators, change agents, enactors, and empowerers. I'm Grant Faulkner, here for another episode of Right Minded, and I'm joined by my very productive co-host, Brooke Warner. Brooke, productivity and juggling projects and hopping around in projects is the theme of today's show. So I'm going to tally up just some of the things you do in your busy life, and then I'm going to ask you how you do it all, because I bet you get that question a lot. So you run She Writes Press and Spark Press, you write and promote books, you do a bunch of public speaking and write articles, you teach memoir classes, you're the chair of the Independent Book Publishers Association, and I know you're super involved in the Bay Area Book Festival as well, especially in their Women Lit series. You're a mom, not to forget that. You build houses for Habitat for Humanity on occasion. You do other things such as this podcast, and I assume you brush your teeth. How do you do it all?
Right. And I floss and I walk my dog. Oh, and yeah, sometimes I go to yoga. Yeah. I mean, the simple answer, I guess, is that I like being busy. I prefer to be busy than not busy, which some people might identify as a strength and others certainly a personality flaw. I wake up really early. I'm super productive in the morning and I'm also a good multitasker. But I also recognize that things get sacrificed sometimes when you're super busy like that. So I don't know. It's a thing. I mean, busy people get more stuff done. That's a truism. Doing begets doing. And I'm very keen on my to-do list and I've always been this way. So there's that question. People do sometimes be like, well, how do you do it all? And I guess the answer is I don't really know any other way to be. And Grant, I know that you likely get the same question. So what's your answer?
Yeah, I like your answer, actually. That's the only way I know to be. That's really the true answer. But yeah, the only way I manage to be a writer, especially amidst work and family and other things, is that I wake up super early, sometimes as early as 3:30 or 4 in the morning, and I can't go back to sleep. So I get up and write for a couple hours. And if I wasn't able to do that, I don't know how I'd write because I'm such a poor evening writer. I guess I'd write about a third as much as I do. And most of that would happen on weekends, which would be really frustrating to me. But one thing I do, and not by choice so much as necessity, is that I've become a project jumper, not even intentionally. I just found myself doing this in the course of a busy life because I'd be working on one book or article for a while, and then I'd shift to another writing project, usually because of deadlines and expectations. But it's created this nice flow where I'll work on nonfiction for a while and then fiction. And this helps me because when I hit a wall or get tired with a project, I can move on to something new. One work tends to feed into the creative juice of another one, you know, kind of mysteriously. And while I'm away from a project, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, I get objectivity while I'm away. So I always come back with like a fresh set of eyes. And the only other thing I'm gonna put out there is I think you have talked about how you like accountability structures, Brooke, and I've discovered this James Clear Journal. I forget what it's called, but it's a fantastic journal because it helps me focus on working new habits into my life, like the ones I'm choosing. And I've kind of become addicted to it because his whole premise is like improving yourself by small amounts. So weaving in a new habit that you want to do into a crowded life. But since we're talking about project jumping, what are your thoughts on jumping to other projects as a way to keep the momentum going?
Mostly, I love it. I think having multiple projects can definitely keep the creative juices flowing. And I also think it's freeing because if you're not in the mood on a given day to do a certain project, then you can switch gears or turn your attention to something else. That said, I do want to offer a caveat because there is an inherent hazard in this for certain types of people who might have a tendency to jump from project to project and then never finish anything. I also think multiple projects should be something like 2 to 4, because every once in a while, someone will contact me, like a prospective coaching client, and tell me that they have something like 12 projects. And my response to that is just like, that is a bit of a problem. And I think it helps to think of these projects as your creative children. How many of them can you reasonably tend to? And then which ones are getting neglected because there's just too many of them total. So when I coach writers who have multiple projects, I say that we're going to choose one. And then this is where the child rearing metaphor flies out the window, because you can't put your children on the back burner. But this is exactly what people need to do with their writing sometimes, is get a priority situation going on where you have like a primary and a secondary, and then the rest don't have to be abandoned, but they can be tended to maybe in lesser ways or later. And then I'll do that for the sake of focus. And I'm not super militant about it. The author can change courses, of course, if they want to. And sometimes they'll let go of one project in favor of another. But I do think if you're going to have multiple projects, which again, I'm a fan of, it's just good to prioritize them so that you're not dabbling around all over the place.
Absolutely. That's great advice. I think it's so easy to become addicted to jumping from project to project, or addicted to just starting new projects. In fact, I think the syndrome of starting things but never finishing them is interesting, because the newness of a project is always seductive. I always say, you know, the novel you haven't written, it always looks better than the novel you are writing. So it's easy to always be starting something new, but it takes sacrifices to finish things. And one of those sacrifices is, you know, some of the new fun ideas you want to pursue until you've finished. I actually have a friend, and he's one of the most creative people in my life, but he specializes in half-finished novels, half-finished songs, half-finished films, and probably half-finished meals. And while he loves his creative work, he's also definitely frustrated that he hasn't reached the end. So if you are a project hopper, you know, always have a plan to finish, because I think that's really necessary. And our guest today, Joanna Penn, she is both a chronic starter and finisher. She's the definition of the entrepreneurial author for me, because she's successful in so many realms, such as podcasting and writing and publishing advice, in addition to her novels. And then she does a lot beyond that. And in her new book, Productivity for Authors, she has a chapter titled Say No and Set Boundaries for Others and for Yourself. And I find saying no, both to other people and myself, one of the most challenging kind of existential challenges. And I'm curious, Brooke, are you good at saying no? And if so, how do you decide what to say no to? I bet you get invited to all sorts of speaking engagements, parties, dinner parties, children's birthday parties, all sorts of things.
Yeah, I guess I have to be honest here and say that I'm not very good at saying no, although that is mostly to new opportunities. When it comes to speaking gigs and projects and collaborations, I tend to say yes or want to say yes. But just recently, I did actually say no to something really big that I wanted to do, because I knew it would require more of me than I could possibly give. And it was hard, but ultimately the right choice. So I guess I'm getting better out of it out of necessity. But in this instance, because I knew I couldn't show up for this person who wanted to collaborate with me, and she's someone I admire, and I knew she deserved more, right? She really needs someone who's going to show up for her in a big way. So that made it, again, the right thing to do to say no. But the other thing about saying yes in general, because I do tend to, is that it's kind of a state of mind. Like, I like people who say yes, and I like being a person who says yes. And I think that's part of the challenge. You know, we're sort of inherently more likable when we're on board, or when we accept challenges, when we rise to occasions, when we pitch in and say, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I've got you. So I think part of my yes problem is that I value saying yes. And there's, of course, also only so much a person can say yes to. And Grant, I know since you said yes to doing this podcast with me, that I already know the answer to the question back to you. How good are you at saying no?
I'm 100% with you. I'm the worst at saying no. I really value, like, I do think it's kind of a character flaw at times, because of what you're saying, that I really do value saying yes in some very deep and intrinsic way. And in fact, if I'm going to say no to something, I'll spend a ridiculous amount of time trying to talk myself into saying yes. You know, I'll basically be doing math equations in my head and taking a pro and con kind of debate stance. It doesn't matter if it's a small or large event. But since this is my son's last year before college, and since I've said yes to too many things over the years, I've decided that this would be my year of saying no so that I can spend more time with him. And I can't say that I'm good at it, but being more deliberate has been helpful. You know, I put things through a more, you know, severe and logical filter. And I find the saying no is really about protecting yourself in the end, your health and your time. So while saying yes can feel generous, it's often, you know, against what's good for you. I think this all takes a lot of practice, though. It's like the act of cleaning out a closet and getting rid of shirts you haven't worn in years. There was a time I could talk myself into keeping almost anything. But now with the influence of Marie Kondo, I'm getting better at saying no to the clutter I create in my closet and my life.
Yeah, well, here to the year of no. Let's see how that goes. We can start practicing it right after this short break. Because for the moment, we're definitely saying yes to the break and yes to talking with the productivity-minded Joanna Penn.
And yes to coming back. So, Brooke, they say that knowledge is power, and thanks to the Great Courses Plus, we get to tap into this power with just one click.
Right, and we've been sharing with listeners this amazing streaming service. Yes, because they're sponsoring our show, but also because in actual fact, you can unlock unlimited access to objective, reliable, fascinating information on virtually any subject.
And don't forget that you also learn from the brightest minds around the world, benefiting from their years of experience and unique insight to help formulate our own knowledge and perspectives.
Right. So we can transform our listeners from students into masters and take over the world.
Woohoo. That's quite an ambition. What's one course you've watched lately, Brooke?
Well, funny enough, for as many great writing classes as there are, there's also so much other fantastic stuff. And since I want James to watch educational content, I sometimes let him choose. And recently he chose zoology, largely, I think, because we recently saw Jumanji 2. And so if you've seen the movie, then you get it. I think my point is, parents, grandparents, this is a really great way to get easy educational content for your kids, too. So how about you, Grant?
Yeah, I like the way they're hitting up the parents and the grandparents. I'm going to add aunts and uncles too. Yeah, since I've been toying around with writing a memoir and or some personal essays, I was happy to discover a course on writing creative nonfiction. And speaking of kids, though, I mentioned to my daughter, Simone, who is 14, how I'd read that the number one thing that kids need help on as college freshmen is writing skills. So she's actually taking a course called High School Language Arts.
The point here is that this power of knowledge can be yours, too, when you sign up for the Great Courses Plus.
And they're offering our listeners their best deal ever. A free trial plus, ready for this, Brooke? Half off their 3-month plan. And my trusty calculator tells me that that's just $10 a month for unlimited knowledge. But to take advantage of this incredible offer, you must sign up today using our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. Rightminded's all one word. One more time, thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded.
You will not be disappointed.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm delighted to introduce our special guest today, Joanna Penn, because she's such a whirlwind of energy and activity that I'm pretty sure she's been cloned. There are 100 things to know about her, probably more than that, actually, but here are just a handful. Joanna has written 30-plus books and sold over 500,000 copies. Some of those books are great writer guides, such as The Successful Author Mindset, Successful Self-Publishing, and How to Be an Author Entrepreneur. Some of those are thrillers published under the pen name J.F. Penn. And one of those thrillers was written in NaNoWriMo 2009. And although she only wrote 20,000 words that year, that became her first published novel. And Joanna is also one of the most entrepreneurial authors I know. Her site, thecreativepen.com, has been voted in the top 100 sites for writers by Writer's Digest. And she also hosts the very popular podcast, The Creative Pen, which includes weekly interviews, inspiration, and information on writing and creativity. It sounds a little bit like Right Minded itself. Welcome, Joanna.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be here. And of course, you've been on my podcast a number of times, so you know what it's about.
Yeah, it's a treat to have you here. And it was a treat to be on your podcast. And actually, the last time I talked to you on your podcast, you made a vow to sign up and win NaNoWriMo 2019. And I'm curious, since you first participated in 2009, if we could do a little time travel, who were you as a writer in 2009? And what did NaNoWriMo do for you, if anything?
Oh, goodness. Well, yeah, back in 2009, I had two nonfiction books. I thought I was a speaker at the time. I had a full-time day job. And on my podcast, which has been going over a decade now, someone said to me, oh, it sounds like you have a bit of a block around writing fiction. And I was like, I don't have any writer's block. You know, that's not me. I don't have any of that. And so I went, well, you know what? I'll just write some fiction. I will do this NaNoWriMo thing. And I just heard about it. And I was, then I realized that I possibly did have some blocks around fiction. And that I, you know, I really thought at that point that the only fiction I was allowed to write was sort of literary fiction or award-winning fiction. My mom was an English teacher. I went to Oxford University, and that was the kind of fiction that I was told I had to write. And then I realized that I actually really loved, you know, Umberto Eco and Dan Brown. I really love these kind of religious thrillers. So I was like, do you know what? I think I'll maybe try and write something like Dan Brown, like the Da Vinci Code. So I did that NaNoWriMo, that first one in 2009. As you say, I wrote 20,000 words, 5,000 of which were decent enough to carry forward into the first draft.
That's a good ratio, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And so that then took me another 14 months or something before I published that. That was Stone of Fire, which is the first book in my Arcane series, which has 10 books now. And since then, I did NaNoWriMo again in 2014, again did about 20,000 words. And yes, I did it in 2019, and I did 15,000 words. So, which all of which says, I think you win NaNoWriMo just by actually doing some words.
Yeah, good, good. That's a good way to package it for others. And but you told me that you, after writing 15,000 words, you went from your novel into something else. So you had goals for two different projects, maybe. Is that right?
Yeah. So basically, because I write fiction and nonfiction, and then within fiction, I also write a number of different subgenres. So action, adventure, thriller, and dark fantasy, and some crime and some horror. And so what I find with my creativity, or my muse, as whatever you want to call it, is that it works better for me if I don't try and force the ideas. I am what they call a discovery writer. Some people call it a pantser. But essentially, I don't have an outline. So I know one of the best ways to win NaNoWriMo is to go in with an outline and then to write those words. But I went in with, this is the type of thing I'm going to write. And then I wrote my 15,000. I was like, do you know what? I need some time to just percolate on this. So I went straight into a nonfiction book that I'm writing, which is an entirely different brain. And I think, you know, I know both of you and Brooke have written nonfiction as well. And it's quite a different brain, I think, than writing a story. And this was a fantasy I was writing. So what it meant is I did get nearly 50,000 words in the month of November, but on different projects. And that would be a tip to anyone listening. Like, if you find it's just not happening, like some people say, well, just go back to the page. And I do say go back to the page, but you might find that writing something else gives your brain a bit of space to think about other things and then come back to it later. And that's definitely my process with novels.
Well, I love how you're able to switch to different books midstream in that way. And I'm wondering, how do you keep creating if you feel like one project needs more percolating? Like, what does that actually look like in practice? And then do you do that very frequently? Like, is that part of your process?
Yeah, definitely. Most of my books, so the Arcane series that I mentioned, book 11, which will be out in 2020, I started researching that at the beginning of 2019, and I've done some research trips. So all of my books have a big basis in reality, and I love traveling, and part of this job is about traveling for research. So I was in Lisbon and I was in Amsterdam, and I did research for that book, and then I write notes and I think about ideas and I get character ideas and setting. And then I keep those in my brain and they're kind of going through that percolation process. And then I haven't even started writing that book yet. That book's coming. But then the other book, Map of the Impossible, which is the one I started, that's a third in a series. So I kind of knew the characters, but then I also knew I needed to do more research. So for me, because I love research and I love travel, that's what I include in my process that brings enrichment to my life and also to my writing. And whereas nonfiction, most of the time I am researching, but that's reading other books, you know, doing stuff myself, experimenting, but it's a very different kind of research. So I can write nonfiction quite quickly if I just sit down and do it. But with my fiction, that first draft takes a while because I'm so heavy on the research and I love it. I know some people don't, but I do.
Well, Joanna, I'd love to keep keep picking up this thread of project jumping, because you're truly juggling a lot of projects on the writing side, the podcasting side, and then all of your entrepreneurial projects as well, the other ones that I haven't mentioned. But can you tell us a little bit more about the genesis of the Creative Pen and what it is, and then why you do it all?
Oh, sure. Well, basically, I started writing my first book around 2006. So this was before self-publishing really took off. You know, it was still sort of a dirty word back then. And I wrote a nonfiction book about career change. And I was living in Australia, which of course is quite a small market compared to, say, the USA or even Britain. So I was in Australia, I wrote this book, and then I looked at the publishing industry, and I knew nothing about publishing up to that point. I was like, I'll write this book and then someone will put it in the world, you know. So basically, I looked at the publishing industry and realized that it might take me a year or two to get an agent, or not at all. It might take a year or two to get a book out in the world. And the type of person I am, I'm a kind of, you know, just go do it type of person. And I was like, that's an awfully long time. I will be ready to do something else within that time. And I was also starting to do speaking events, and many speakers do self-publish their books and always have. So I was kind of encouraged to get into print self-publishing before the Kindle even appeared. So I did that. And what happened in that process is I got horrifically ripped off by some unscrupulous people in the industry. And I was so angry about it that I decided to start a blog about what I was learning about self-publishing. And I also discovered, you know, search engine optimization and podcasting and all of that around 2008. And I thought, well, I'll start this site and I'll just share what I learn, and that will help somebody. And that is basically what I've done now for over a decade. And like, I have content for the next 6 months, you know, the podcast is still going. And I think that just shows you, I mean, I left my job in 2011 because I was making enough money. My husband left his job in 2015 to join the business. So what's happened is it's gone from a sort of personal blog and a podcast I started before it was called podcasting, to a sort of multi six figure global business. So, and I would encourage people there, you know, sometimes you just have to get started. I mean, the first podcast interview I did, I phoned someone up on a phone and put it on speakerphone and held an MP3 player next to it because, you know, that was all I had at the time. And yeah, so I guess I've just learned along the way, but I've learned in public. And in that decade, obviously, we've seen the rise of self-publishing, or Brooke, I think I love your green light to your book idea, you know, sort of green lighting your own project. And that's kind of what I've done, I guess.
Oh, so much so. And your stuff is so popular, and all the writers that I know love what you're doing. So thank you. And it's interesting to hear about your trajectory. And I want to spend a second on the Creative Pen podcast, because you have interviewed hundreds of writers. And I know we take away so much from these interviews. And we wanted to know what have been maybe one or two of the greatest takeaways from your podcast.
That's a pretty difficult question after a decade. But I think it's interesting, well, on a sort of meta level, the idea of podcasting to me, and I think partly why you guys do it too, is every single interview, you will learn something new, or a new angle on a topic that you think you already know, or a little tidbit that might make you more money or change the way you think. So the biggest thing I've learned is that never underestimate a discussion from my own learning perspective, but also other people's perspective. And this is so important as well for creatives listening. You know, we all get very worried about what we put out in the world, that people are going to judge us. You know, fear of judgment is my biggest issue by far. And I've had that with the podcast, you know, every time. I mean, even before coming on here, you know, my heart's beating fast, I'm nervous, and I've done hundreds of these. But as an introvert author, putting yourself out over the airwaves is actually incredibly powerful. So I would say, if you're listening and you are worried about this kind of thing, at this point, podcasting is an incredibly powerful way to reach readers through sound. So that will probably be the biggest thing I've learned, is that every time I've thought about giving the podcast up, because let's face it, it takes some time, I've gone, do you know what? I still get a lot of, you know, I get so much from it that I can't possibly give it up from a creative perspective or a business perspective or the people who listen. And I will never hear from most people who listen to the show, but when I do hear from people or I meet people, they're like, you know, the podcast is the thing. So sometimes we think we can change people's lives with our books, but we can also change people's lives with our words. So I think that's probably the biggest shift, is realizing that audio can change lives. And my show has been downloaded in 220 countries.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
Well, on the topic of doing it all, which you obviously do, you have a new book out, Productivity for Authors. Can you tell us about it a bit and share some of your favorite productivity tips? I think everyone's always looking for a new productivity tip.
Yeah. Well, and it's so funny because I've thought about writing this book for years, and then I had a bit of a moment about 18 months ago, and I realized that although I do a lot of what I do is pointless. this is one of those horrible things when you realize how much time you might have wasted. And the thing is, you have to have this feeling, you have to go through this process quite regularly. I think you have to look at things and go, seriously, is this worth my time? You know, like Facebook, I took Facebook off my phone about 3 years ago, and I certainly don't miss it. you know, you have to assess what works for you in terms of your goals. So that is the number one tip from the book is, okay, there are some more, you know, do this, do that type of thing. But the number one thing is, what do you want to achieve? So if people listening, if you have just, let's say you've just done NaNoWriMo or you've finished a first draft, what you want to achieve is an edited draft. That is your next step. So what are the things that you need to do in order to achieve that goal? Or somebody listening, maybe they have 5 novels, but they're not making any money. So what they need to do is make money with their books. Well, that has a completely different set of things you have to do. And once you've decided on your goal, that's when you need to look at everything you're doing and you need to get rid of some things. And that really is the number one tip. You have to get rid of things. I did things like I realized I was spending sort of 2 hours a day answering email, which is kind of crazy. So I got my assistant to start taking on my email, because most queries, I'm sure you guys know, are things like, how do I write a book? Stuff like that. How do I self-publish a book? Yeah, they're things you can just copy and paste. So that would be the two tips. You have to decide what you want, and then you have to get rid of the things. That might mean you get rid of them for 6 months, or you might get rid of them for good, but you have to do things to make the time to achieve the goal you want to achieve.
Right. Such good advice. And I love that. I mean, obviously, as you grow in your business, you also have to enlist some help even beyond your husband. I'm curious about self-publishing in general. I mean, it's come such a long way. As you said, when you were starting, it was a dirty word, and now it's a thing. So what is the most important thing an author should know when self-publishing? And are there any particular myths that you'd like to dispel?
Yeah, there is a myth straight away, and that is self-publishing. It is, to me, and I use the term self-publishing still because that is the term in the industry, but I work with about 12 different freelancers at this point. So I work with different editors for my fiction and my nonfiction. I work with beta readers. I work with proofreaders, cover designers, website people. I have print formatters. I have an audiobook producer. So I work with all of these different people that you would in a professional publishing house. So to me, the phrase independent publisher is probably better. I actually have an imprint, Curl Up Press, which is what I publish my books under. So probably that is the biggest myth. I mean, there are still a lot of people who, you know, maybe self-publish one book, that's fine. But those of us who do this for a living, who take it, I guess, this is my career, this is my income. I don't self-publish. I independently publish. That's probably the biggest myth. And then the most important thing to consider is exactly that dichotomy. It's, what is your definition of success? So I used to be a consultant for, in large corporates. I made a good money, 6-figure salary. I was never going to give up that to be a poor author in a garret. So always for me, a definition of success was to make a good living with my writing. But actually, I've discovered over the years that is not most people's reason for writing. I think, you know, some people just want to have their book in the world, which is fantastic. You know, some people, they want a publisher or they want a literary prize. Fantastic. But you have to decide on what you want to achieve, because that is going to shape to some extent the book you write, but also how you publish and how you market your book. As you guys know, if you want to win a literary prize, you pretty much need to be traditionally published still, you know, or if you want to hit some Sunday Times list in the UK, it's not open to all books. So you have to decide what you want to achieve and then figure out the best way to help you achieve that.
That's great advice, Joanna. And in closing, I'm curious, so just opening this up relatively widely, why would you say an author should self-publish? What are some of the benefits one should focus on in terms of defining success?
I think it is a personality type. I used to say everyone can be successful as an author entrepreneur, as I put it. But as I've said, I think you have to really decide what you want. And being an independent author really suits the type of person who likes to be in control. I think, you know, most of us successful indie authors are sort of control freaks in some way. Also to be business minded. So for example, I work with agents and publishers in foreign rights negotiation, for example, film rights, that type of thing. So it's not about being anti-traditional publishing. I have traditional publishing deals in other countries, other languages, but it is about controlling your creative intellectual property assets. And many authors don't describe their books as intellectual property assets, which I do. And also, yeah, so control is a big one. I think business and money, if you want to make, I mean, you can make money, obviously, as a traditionally published author, but you have a lot more control over your pricing, over your marketing, over your options. You know, I've now published books, well, actually sold books in 93 countries. And you can be open to the possibilities as they arise. You don't have to ask permission to do things. So all of those things suit a particular personality type. I think the creativity side is common across all authors, but the desire to project manage the publication and the marketing side is not necessarily for everyone. So that's probably the message of this interview, is what do you want to do with your creativity, and what is the best way to go about that?
We will leave listeners with that question. That's fantastic, Joanna. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for all the work you're doing out in the world, Joanna.
Thank you.
We will be right back, everybody, with today's takeaway.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back for this week's takeaway. One key to being a productive author is to identify if anything is stopping you from reaching your goals and what that thing or those things might be. And so I think this is a good exercise because I find it personally easy to fool myself that I'm getting more done than I'm actually getting done. You can say I'm working on my novel for years and never quite finishing it. And so since this is the beginning of the year, I think it's a good time for introspection on how you achieve your goals, what you go about to make them to be successful in them. So this is an exercise of excavating your life a bit. So again, sit down with you know, your favorite writing tools or devices and identify your goals. You know, think long term, and then more importantly, short term. Your goals could be as big as publishing a novel or as small as journaling every day. But think about how you've been pursuing them, especially if you've been pursuing them for a year or 5 years or 10 years or more. This is when it gets a little scary, because you have to think about what you've done right to make them happen, and then think about what obstacles have prevented you from reaching your goals, whether those obstacles are from outside yourself or from within. So while you're doing this, think about what is one small thing you can change. I really believe in this notion that if you can introduce like one small new habit or get rid of one small thing you're doing that's preventing you from achieving the things you want to do, that behavior change will have ripple effects, and other small things will follow, and maybe other big things as well.
Thanks for that, Grant. And everybody, Right Minded is your favorite weekly podcast, we hope. Download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's been a little while since we've read a review, so I have a fun one from Doc Pangloss, which is a little bit of a sad name, although it could be Doc Pangloss. also, so that wouldn't be so sad. And he or she writes, I listen to many, too many, writing-related podcasts, and Right Minded is a winner. The hosts are personable, articulate, and engaging. They feature a terrific list of literary guests and offer great encouragement for listeners who want to improve their writing. Give it a listen and you'll see for yourself. So I like that one because it feels very review-y, which is fun. Thank you for that. And thanks to everybody who's been rating us. We appreciate it. We will see you next week.